Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Everybody, so a great one today, just the best, the absolutely brilliant Dahlia Lithwick. No one better. Now, I say that even though I've said a number of times on this podcast that Heather McGee is my favorite guest. And let me clarify, all this is a conceit, you see, a comic conceit, like a good one for a change. That's a conceit, because if the norm was that almost all of these shows were shitty, you wouldn't be listening, right? So a good one for a change, a comic conceit. Heather McGee, my favorite guest, it's also a conceit, except it's a different kind of conceit, because a good one for a change, the conceit is, of course, that isn't true. Heather, Jesus Christ, she's good. If you haven't listened to my Heather McGee podcast, just go listen. But not until you listen to this one, because Dahlia Lithwick is the best. Dahlia is a senior editor at Slate and writes about the Supreme Court brilliantly. And there's a lot to talk about the Supreme Court these days. All of it very disturbing. I don't consider this a legitimate court. As far as I'm concerned, they stole two seats. One from Merrick Garland, when they wouldn't take him up in 2016, supposedly on the principle that it was a presidential election year. Scalia died in February of 2016. And then Coney Barrett, who they seated just 8 or 9 days before the 2020 election. And that's led to Dobbs and so much more. We're still in the middle of Mifepristone. That's gone now to the Fifth Circuit, which is not promising. There's the attack on the administrative state. Last session, they ruled that the EPA can't control CO2 emissions, overturning previous rulings by the court. And speaking of Mifepristone, the FDA approved it 20 years ago. 20 years ago. So if you're talking about attacking the administrative state, you're attacking the FDA, which approved a drug 20 years ago. And then there's the hilarious and deeply disturbing corruption. Clarence Thomas not reporting luxury vacations paid for by this billionaire, Harlan Crow. That's perfect. Perfect name. Harlan Crow. I mean, we're talking about being flown on Crow's private jet to far-flung locations. Far-flung, by the way, is not Yiddish, far-flung. It sounds Yiddish. It isn't. When I say far-flung, far-flung locations like the Indonesia archipelago, where Thomas and his wife Ginny spent 9 days of island hopping to a volcanic archipelago on a super yacht staffed by a coterie of attendants and a private chef. As we say in Minnesota, must be nice. And there's many other similarly luxurious vacations that he's taken with this guy that, you know, must be nice. And you might have heard this bullshit from some interview with Thomas on some bullshit documentary.
I prefer the RV parks. I prefer the Walmart parking lots to the beaches and things like that. There's something normal to me about it. I come from regular stock, and I prefer that.
See, Thomas says he grew up very humbly, but nothing compared to my childhood. The Frankens lived in a porta potty, and my brother and I had to do our homework at night with a flashlight. I had to sit on his shoulders and shine the flashlight down while we did our homework. So all I can say about Thomas's childhood must be nice. God. Okay. Dahlia and I discuss a lot of stuff, and it's a disturbing one. We start talking about the Trump town hall, and it gets worse from there. But it's also a great one, you know, for a change. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
You're my second favorite guest.
Stop.
No, I do. That's I just love Heather, and I love you too. That's
and I love you less, Dahlia.
a little slightly less. So yes, you missed the Trump press conference, huh? Or not press conference? What that was? That was a town hall. Was boy, it was not a press conference.
Well, it kind of was.
Too bad. No, a press conference isn't always just correcting a lie. And it was constant lying. And then I looked up some fact checks later, but all of them just had like 6 lies. And there were like 100 lies. It was just a constant stream of lies. And my favorite was that our United States military has run out of ammunition. We've given so much ammunition to Ukraine that we've run out of ammunition. The Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Air Force, we have all run out of ammunition. And I wish he hadn't said that, because we are very vulnerable to attack now. But it was just all crazy lies. And then also it was supposedly independent, or people hadn't made up their mind. Republicans hadn't made up their mind, and they were all just worshipful and screaming, and it was sickening.
Yeah, and his, like, killing the baby at birth.
You know, I don't know how long after the birth he thinks we still consider it's okay to kill a baby.
I think that the most interesting stuff I saw the morning after is from all the people who study authoritarianism and, like, fascism. Because what they say is, first of all, just generally doing a live fact check is stupid, because there's just no way to fact check him in real time. And even if she tried to get him on little things like the election wasn't stolen, Mr. Trump. There were 60 court cases that, but even if she tried to get him a couple times, the thing that these folks are reminding us, and I think this is maybe worth surfacing, is that the performance of being able to lie and being checked and not caring and doubling down on the lie is like a real cornerstone of how autocrats do it. In other words, it's not him against facts. That's the mistake you make. It's him against people who believe in facts. And every single time he either speaks over her or he reasserts the same lie that she's called him out on, what he's actually doing is proving that lying is his superpower and that he doesn't care. And I think that's kind of a useful frame because we keep thinking, oh, this is, you know, marketplace of ideas and she's going to smoke out his lies and the listeners are going to be persuaded. Like the listeners love the fact that he doesn't care about truth. And each time he performs that, they love it more.
That I think is very profound and true. And I can't get my brain to believe it. And I was watching this thing and I was thinking CNN said they brought in all these people who hadn't made up their mind, but that clearly just wasn't true. They were all cheering pretty much anything he said, including calling E. Jean Carroll a whack job and Caitlin Collins a nasty person. Truth doesn't matter anymore, right? It doesn't matter anymore.
That is correct.
Or at least a lot to a lot of people. And that's just hard for me to accept, but that's I have to adapt here, right?
I think that the other tiny manifestation of this that doesn't rise to the level of what we saw on CNN is that he, by a unanimous jury in Manhattan, they all find that he's a liar, right? He tries to sort of say, oh, these are, you know, the tea-sipping elites, you know, the kale eaters that populate Manhattan with their yoga mats. And in fact, that's not the jury at all. The jury is six men, and the jury is a lot of people from Trump country, upstate. It's interesting because when he dismisses the fact-finding of a unanimous jury that both found him to be a sexual abuser and a defamer, right? A person who lies under a really high standard, like the standard for defamation is almost unmeetable, and he went ahead and met it. And for him to dismiss them as part of some lefty conspiracy of liars, it's the same thing he's doing by setting himself against CNN. He's saying that entire network is a cabal of liberal liars and he exists to assert power over them. That's the same thing he's doing with that jury. He's saying these are not regular people like you. These were handpicked, you know, liberal Marxist communists who hate me. And I just think it's worth, just to answer your question, this is not a war on whatever truth it is they found. It's a war on the people who find truth or seek truth. And that's really next level creepy authoritarian play. It's a way of discrediting, in CNN's case, the entire media. And in the case of this jury, he's saying, I don't care what Fani Willis does eventually. I don't care what Jack Smith does eventually, because those jurors are not your people. They're liars.
So that sets that up.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I had this thing after, and I asked this of Dan Balls. My first question to him was, when the Manhattan charge came in on paying off the porn star, I thought, okay, of course his support's going to go up among Trump people because they're thinking, well, that's really thin, and it's not that's ridiculous. But isn't support for him going to go down as one after one after one of these, especially like Georgia and maybe the documents, but also January 6th, won't support in the Republican Party go down? And then I thought to myself, maybe I'm wrong. And I said, what do you think? And he said, I think maybe you're wrong. And last night, after watching last night, I'm thinking I'm wrong. Am I wrong?
I think you're wrong. I thought, listen, President Biden's tweet was, do you want 4 more years of this, right? I mean, I think that there is, for the reality-based community, this reflexive sense that, like, oh, he's, you know, a jury just unanimously found, as a matter of fact and law, that he is a defamer and a sexual abuser, his support's going to go down. And it doesn't seem to. I think that, you know, you saw an enthusiastic audience on Wednesday night applauding as he made fun of the victim in that trial. Like, they thought it was hilarious. Applauding as he kind of winkingly said Mike Pence kind of deserved what he got on January 6th. So I don't think that this wish casting, oh, it's just going to happen, you know, at some point it'll go too far. I think the thing I'm trying to say, and this is incredibly depressing, is that not only is the fact that he's lying, the fact that he's making fun of E. Jean Carroll, the fact that he's saying he's going to pardon all of the insurrectionists who, you know, stormed the Capitol and in fact killed people. I think that what he's doing is not just seeding the ground, as we just agreed, for the future thing that comes, right? For the next thing. But he's doing this attack on institutions of truth, whether it's the press, whether it's the jury in this case, whether it's Alvin Bragg, right? Alvin Bragg, like, brings an indictment, not because it's a thing he carries around in his back pocket. It's because after doing a crap ton of work, they determined that he'd broken New York financial crimes laws. So what he does is he time and time again makes these claims that, you know, it's a witch hunt, everyone's out to get him, that the people he's lying about are in fact the liars. And I think what I'm trying to say is it's a one-way ratchet, because every time he does this, he discredits
a one-way ratchet.
Yes.
I like that. Yeah.
You like that? Yeah, Heather McGee doesn't say one-way ratchet. I think that okay. it's a way of, as he goes, laying down tracks for the next institution he's going to discredit. And I don't think the aggregate effect is what we think it is. The walls are closing in on Donald Trump. I think the aggregate effect is the walls are kind of crumbling because he's blowing them up as he goes.
I saw that John Cornyn, after the E. Jean Carroll verdict, said he can't be our nominee, but it was kind of him. I didn't hear a lot of other Republican. So they're all, I guess he just got reelected for 6 years and probably isn't worried. Maybe he felt he could do that. I like the candidates who've declared, who would say things like Pence said, well, that's, you know, for really for him to answer. No, we just asked you if this bothers you that he was convicted of sexual abuse and defamation. Well, I think that you should really ask him about that. I mean, this is how he got nominated in the first place, right? No one would go after him who was running against him because they're afraid of him.
Right, because he's a bully. Yeah.
Well, they're afraid of his supporters, too. And remember in 16, it was all like Cruz and others who thought, well, I'm not going to attack him. I'm going to let, you know, Jindal attack him or Bush attack him. I'll let the weak ones attack him and get wiped out by him. And then I'll hang in there. And who's ever still remaining will get his supporters and be the nominee. We couldn't possibly nominate Donald Trump. But isn't that what happened last time?
I think so. And I think the other imperceptible change, I think the first one you're identifying is right, which is just Republicans running through the halls of Congress saying, like, I don't know. I didn't read the jury, you know, form. I have no idea. Right. Like, I don't know. And I think they've perfected the art of, like, running away and waving their hands and getting in the elevator. But I think the thing that is this other almost imperceptible shift that you're sort of flicking at that has really happened is that everybody thought it was a joke in 2016. They were like, he's not a real candidate. This is ridiculous. Like, this is reality show politics. And so people sort of didn't take this as seriously as they should. I think the reason that I'm so mad at CNN is that if you learned nothing else in the intervening years, take this seriously. And so the idea that, oh, you know, he's a, you know, serious candidate, therefore we have to put him in front of an audience of people who applaud, you know, when he makes sex abuse jokes. Like, I think what's scary is that we understand now that this could happen, and that what happens when Donald Trump gets elected is the travel ban and family separation and other horrible things. And instead of saying, wow, that's a genuine existential threat, we're like, okay, let's watch it again. Good show.
I think that, you know, if you thought the last one was a genuine existential threat, the first administration, this one just starts where the last one ended. He doesn't pick any serious people to be in the cabinet and to be around him. And he uses the Justice Department in the way he wants to. And I mean, we're looking at the end of democracy.
I think that's right. And I think that I love that adorable nervous laugh when you say the sentence, end of democracy. Waka waka. I think the other thing, you and I have talked about this, is, you know, all around the country, we are seeing state houses ending democracy, right? Whether it's changing the threshold for getting something on the ballot, whether it's saying, oh, you know, Fani Willis, we're taking away her power to try cases.
Right. The Georgia state legislature has talked about doing that, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think they really have, and this is happening, by the way, around the country, that we're seeing particularly Black female prosecutors. Sherilyn Ifill said this on my podcast a few weeks ago, and it really gave me chills, that Black women prosecutors are actually being stripped of their power to try certain cases and bring certain cases. But this is also
happening? Where has that happened exactly?
Well, she mentioned Fani Willis in Georgia. She mentioned Florida.
Well, let's talk about what precisely what that was, which is Georgia legislators were talking about essentially the legislature being able to fire or get rid of prosecutors, county prosecutors, right?
Yeah, I think that this is, it's not just in Georgia. And the way she started this conversation, just for what it's worth, is that Mitch McConnell gets very, very sick. And typically, he would be replaced by a nonpartisan process. But he has put a process in place in Kentucky that means he will be replaced by a Republican. So her example that she was giving, and this is, by the way, of a piece.
Well, normally the governor would appoint someone to take his place.
Yes.
And in this case, it's a Democratic governor in Kentucky. So they changed the process in the state legislature?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Okay, of course.
Sherilyn wrote a kind of staggering piece about this, and it's happening in a weird, creepy subterranean way, and we're not connecting the dots. But it's of a piece with Tennessee stripping three duly elected legislators of
only
their power.
Two.
Well, two, two. And it's of a piece with, you know, around the country, these efforts by red states to say, we're no longer interested in what's called, you know, democracy suppression, right? We're not talking about gerrymandering. We're not talking about voter ID. We're actually taking away powers from duly elected officials to do their job. And that's happening all around the country. And often it's happening in response to groups in states trying to get abortion protections or gun protections. And so they're just saying, oh, yeah, no, now we're going to, you need a supermajority to do that. Now you need. And so I think what Sherilyn said to me and what I'm trying very poorly to explain is that we're always kind of fighting the last war. We think this is about people in Georgia have to, you know, stand in line and they can't get water. This is so beyond suppressing votes. This is saying voters vote for somebody and then that person can't do their job, which is fundamentally democracy subversion and not suppression. And I guess I'm just trying to connect that up. It's a version of, you know, when we talk about the existential stuff that's coming, that independent state legislature case, you know, Moore v. Harper.
Now, has that gone away because the North Carolina Supreme Court flipped and they reversed the old gerrymander?
It hasn't gone away. The court just asked for briefing from both parties on it. I suspect the court may kick it away because it's actually, I mean, it was a dumb case to begin with.
What happened is the old Democratic majority Supreme Court had thrown out a gerrymandered map that the Republican state legislature had put together that was just ridiculous. And then the Republican state legislature sued to the Supreme Court, went to the Supreme Court and said, the state Supreme Court doesn't have power over us. We the state legislatures should have all the power to determine voting rules in the state. And now this new Republican Supreme Court has upheld the egregiously gerrymandered map that the Republican state legislature had put together. It was right on gerrymandering.
Exactly right. That
okay. Well said.
Yeah, no. It's that the state Supreme Court has zero power to intervene in anything to do with elections under the Constitution, and that the state essentially can do whatever the hell it wants. It can draw whatever maps it wants, and there is nothing to check that because the state's power, the legislative branch's power over elections, is plenary. And if the court were to grant that, which I think, as we are now saying, it looks like the court's going to kick it away because the court flipped and they were like, oh, this gerrymander's fine. And so now it's...
That's what happened, yeah. That case may go away.
It may go away. But you know, there are four justices who have, in earlier cases, signaled approval of that theory that state legislatures have plenary, unreviewable power. And it's just, I guess I'm lining it up with all these other examples I'm giving of, you know, gerrymandered red state legislatures essentially saying, yeah, democracy for you is over. And that because it's happening in these kind of weird granular ways in all sorts of different ways, we're not, I think, clocking the big picture, which is there's 100 different ways to make voters' rights go away. And thinking that it only happens on election day is kind of missing the very pernicious shift that's happening right now.
When did the Supreme Court decide that it couldn't get involved in partisan gerrymandering? In other words, it couldn't look at partisan gerrymandering going like, no, you can't do that.
That was the Rucho case in 2019. And
2019.
Kind of hilariously, what the court said is, we don't need to get involved with that because state Supreme Courts can take care of it. So here we are a couple of years later, and the claim is, oh, but also state Supreme Courts can't get involved in that either. It's a sort of example of the slippery slope where the court says, you know, we're getting rid of Section 4 of the voting rights in Shelby County, but you can use Section 2. And then this term now, of course, they're doing a case that will get rid of Section 2. So it's that kind of Lucy football stuff that the court has gotten really deft at doing.
But at least it goes to the Supreme Court, right?
Thank God. Thank God we have a bulwark to protect.
So if a state Supreme Court has no power over it now to overturn an incredibly awful partisan gerrymand, at least it goes to the Supreme Court to make that decision. Or does it?
As you may yes, it does. That's one of the critiques that a lot of people who hate this Moore v. Harper case are like, wait, so the Supreme Court is putting itself in the business of reviewing state legislative election practices? But actually, it's kind of a funny coda to the, you may recall, Al, when we talked after Dobbs came down, the court said, hey, and we are officially out of the abortion business. We're going to send that to the states. And here we are, less than a year later, with the court involved in, you know, an effort to pull FDA approval of one of two drugs in the medication abortion protocol. So my general rule at this point is that if the Supreme Court says they're out of the X business, they're really in the X business.
So where are we on the X, the myth of
Mifepristone, you did it.
Oh, good. Okay. So where are we on that now? What did the court decide?
So we had a judge in the Fifth Circuit, Matthew Kaczmarek, In case folks are wondering why he got this case, it's because if you put a coin in the vending machine in Amarillo, Texas, the only judge you will get, like a Snickers bar, is Matthew Kaczmarek. So he gets this case. It's deliberately filed in his jurisdiction. As people will recall, he was like, yeah, mifepristone, you know, yes, it was. It got FDA approval 23 years ago, but that's over now. And tried to gave a week, at which point it was going to be pulled nationwide. And then we had a Fifth Circuit panel intervene and say, we're not going to actually do away with it altogether. We're going to go back to the 2016 regulations, which were very, very onerous. Required doctor's visits, multiple visits. It was very, very onerous and unnecessary. And that was the state of play until a couple weeks ago when the U.S. Supreme Court, in another one of its shadow docket, unsigned, inscrutable stays, said, no, we're going to go back to the status quo. So this case gets kicked back to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeal, which will have to actually make some decisions about it. But they announced the panel this week, and it's not a great panel for reproductive freedom. And I guess the other little coda is that Justice Alito, we don't know what the vote was to stay it. We know that Justice.
But he said something. He
did one of
had a hissy fit.
His little grumpy grams that he does. And he hilariously singled out all the people on the court who were making him mad. And he name checked Justice Sotomayor, Justice Kagan, and Justice Amy Coney Barrett for disappointing him. So just weirdly, all women, who knows. But he and Justice Thomas clearly would have allowed mifepristone to go off the market.
Well, but he didn't, not Brown Jackson, he didn't criticize her?
She hasn't written about this yet, but give him time. Give him time.
Oh, okay. And then, but we had a different court say that we want to keep this mifepristone, right? And but it, and all isn't this about what, like, can the FDA do its job? Isn't the Food and Drug Administration, which that's who decides what drugs are, you know, safe and all that stuff, not courts, right?
That used to be the rule, but it also used to be the rule that, you know, states would determine their own gun regulations. Now the Supreme Court does it. We used to have, you know, school boards determining their own, you know, church state accommodations. Now the Supreme Court does it. I mean, the Supreme Court is a kind of wood chipper for constitutional doctrine and, you know, purporting to be like judicial humility and balls and strikes. What they're in fact doing is taking settled precedent. And I know you and I have talked about this 100 times that everybody can rely on and saying, yeah, no, that's not the law anymore, but we'll let you know when we figure out what the law is. And maybe the most important thing I could say about any of this is that if folks are reading the accounts of hospitals in Texas that have to now wait until a woman bleeds out, until she is septic, until her blood pressure drops to the point that she's almost dead before they can intervene. The point of all this is not just chilling providers, right? Making sure that every provider in the country doesn't know what the law is today and the FDA isn't sure what the law is this week. It's making sure that that sense of like, it's all unsettled, I can't figure it out, I don't presently know how to construct a legal regime to approve, you know, abortifacients.
Has someone been prosecuted yet for performing abortion when a mother's health and life was in danger? Has anyone been prosecuted for that yet?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I'm going to confess that I'm not sure I know the answer to that.
I mean, there's been a chilling effect. And
oh, for sure.
As you say, I mean, there's been a lot of women facing very dangerous situations and not it not being addressed and being scared that they're going to die.
There are physicians leaving the practice. We, you know, are hearing shocking reports of physicians just saying, I can't be, you know, an emergency physician or an obstetrician in the state of Texas because I don't know when I'm going to get sued. But there's this unbelievable lawsuit where a guy went after his ex-wife's, now ex-wife's, three friends who helped her get a medication abortion pill after Dobbs, immediately after Dobbs. And he went after them. And his evidence is the texts that they shared. And it's a stunning, stunning, stunning case. Jonathan Mitchell, the guy who cooked up SB 8, the Texas vigilante bill, is right. one of the lawyers in this case. But think of what it means to be checking your estranged wife's texts with her friends and using that as evidence that they colluded to murder your child. And then it goes one step further. Last week, we found out he actually went into her purse, found the medication, let her go ahead and take it, and now is going after the friends in court. So, like, the whole purpose here, in addition to chilling professionals who are trying to provide service, is terrorizing pregnant people so that their friends are afraid to help them. And everybody is afraid about what they say or what they put in a text, because someday you could be on the hook, as these women are, for aiding and abetting a murder. That's where we are. And I think I don't like to be the bearer of, like, super sad news, but the component of these abortion regulations that is surveilling speech and conduct should, like, make all our eyebrows be on fire.
Okay, so far this hasn't been a lot of fun in terms of, well, dark stuff can be fun, and you make it as fun as possible, but we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Dahlia Lithwick.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
We're back with the great Dahlia Lithwick. You're talking about balls and strikes. I heard balls and strikes, and that made me think of Roberts. I've made the case that he's the worst because he doesn't call balls and strikes. So he is the Chief Justice, and we're seeing all this money and gifts and vacations flowing to the Thomas family. Robert seems to be not caring at all, and he won't testify. Let me ask you about that. When the Judiciary Committee asked him to testify and he said no, is there any precedence for that either way?
His claim in his little letter back to the Judiciary Committee is that it would violate judicial independence and the separation of powers for him to come testify in this ethics hearing last week. And first of all, justices have been testifying before Congress from the jump, and Roberts himself has testified, as have other justices. So this was one of those things where it was like, I'm just going to wave my hands around and say judicial independence. And that erases the fact that people have been testifying in front of Congress for a long time. But the more interesting slash troubling thing about this is the thing you started with, which is John Roberts keeps pretending that he actually has no power to do anything, that he's just, you know, minding the store, and that the eight other justices are kind of nine, you know, that they're all nine independent law firms, and that there's nothing he can do or say to force them to conform to the rules.
That doesn't seem to be true. I mean, what happened in the Fortas case?
Right. That's exactly the thing. In 1969, Fortas, who is, right, a liberal, first is charged with, you know, doing $20,000 legal work from this stock manipulator's Family Foundation. Then he took $15,000 to teach some classes at American University.
Okay.
Those are the stakes, right? And Chief Justice Earl Warren, also a liberal, essentially forces Fortas off the court. He and the other justices just sit down with Fortas and they're like, the court's welfare and effectiveness are more important than anything. And they forced him to resign.
Does Roberts know this history?
I mean, I haven't discussed it with him. If folks want to read a really good book, Adam Cohen's amazing book, Supreme Inequality, goes through not just the TikTok of how they get him off the court, but the ways in which this whole thing is engineered by Nixon, who's trying to get liberals off the court so he can replace them. And Nixon is sending his actual attorney general to go have meetings with Earl Warren saying, like, this guy's going to jail. Here's the dossier. Like, you better do something. So the idea, and I'm not suggesting that Biden should send Merrick Garland to rough up the Chief Justice, but I am saying in 1969, the court looked around and said, this fairly trivial violation is so bad for the court's effectiveness and for public confidence in the court that we're going to leave our friend to twist and just like throw him out. And here we have all these years later, you know, $500,000 luxury travel, you know, his mom's house paid for by Harlan Crow, rent free, the grandnephew's tuition. None of this is disclosed. And then at the end of last week, oh, by the way, Leonard Leo arranges to have Ginny Thomas paid $25,000 through Kelly Conway's polling company with a note that says, quote, no mention of Ginny. And this stuff is like, you know, justice got a justice. I don't know. This is the maniacal laughter of the distressed.
Now, first of all, the guy who paid for most of this is Harlan Crow, okay? He doesn't have to, as far as I'm concerned, have business before the court. He's a billionaire to have an interest in conservative justices because everything this court does helps billionaires, right?
Yes.
I mean, in other words, he doesn't have to have a case before the court for this to be improper because any billionaire knows that this conservative court is pretty much in his interest. Does he actually have actual stuff before the court, or does he just have a general interest in conservatives doing well or in bribing them or whatever you want to say it is?
You know, Sheldon Whitehouse would say, not only does he have business before the court, his business is the court, right? He's been pouring money into different projects, front groups associated with Leonard Leo, who, you know, not just at the Federalist Society, but at all these different groups have been, you know, pouring tons and tons of money into judicial nominations, right? Into making sure that Merrick Garland doesn't get hearings, into making sure that Justice Alito and Thomas and later Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and Barrett all get seated. So there's part of it that is, you know, his business is the court. It's reshaping the court. And he's put a ton of money into that. But even right now, there are three cases at the court where the Manhattan Institute has amicus briefs. And you know whose wife is a trustee of the Manhattan Institute? Why? It's Kathy Crow, wife of Harlan Crow. So he, on both fronts, kind of fails. In both ways.
Family
thing. He is not just pouring money into reshaping the court. And by the way, some of Leonard Leo's front groups are working on that issue we talked about earlier, which is vote suppression and democracy suppression. So they're working on that too. But then also, yes, there's business before the court, not just because, as you say, he benefits from the knock-on effects of having the court attack the regulatory state, right, in the EPA case or other cases. He benefits from Citizens United. He had one of the front groups that actually paid the money to Ginny Thomas in that most recent scandal in 2012. Had an amicus brief in Shelby County. So, like, it's all so gross. And the arguments that are made, which is like, oh, but they're really close friends, so it's okay. Or, well, you know, it's unless you can show that Clarence Thomas changed his vote after Harlan Crow like drop Scrooge McDuck bags of money on his desk, then there's no corruption here. And all of that is just false. Clarence Thomas, if he's going to take all these gifts, he has to disclose them. And he doesn't disclose them because he has a theory of disclosure, Al, that he's had for years and years, which is fabulous people don't have to disclose. That's his Citizens United opinion. That's been his opinion all along. He thinks he's too fancy for disclosure.
And we can't hear Robert's opinion on that because he won't testify.
I think Robert's, in the most generous construction of the problem, and by the way, I agree with your, you know, remarks on how dangerous he has been to the country and how dangerous it is to hold him out as a centrist moderate when he has been a juggernaut against voting rights, a juggernaut for money in politics, a juggernaut on doing away with race protections in this country and reproductive rights. So, like, let's call him what he is, which is an incredibly conservative political actor who happens to now be at the center of the court. But I do think that even if I was being fair and said he's just worried about protecting the institutional legitimacy and the reputational interests of the court, like, that stuff is in the toilet. Those numbers are lower than they've been since polling began.
Well, also, if he cares about the reputation of the court, then he would get rid of Thomas. I mean, but he doesn't want to lose a conservative. Well, yeah, because Biden is the president and we have the Senate. So, but I mean, it, the reputation of the court, and as you say, it's in the toilet anyway. Where are the approval ratings of the court now?
I mean, it depends on which polls you look at. You know, they're in the low 40s, the high 30s, but, you know, they've dropped precipitously in just a few short years. And even, you know, Republicans and independents who actually like the doctrinal changes going after the court don't like the misconduct they're seeing because, believe it or not, this isn't a monarchy. And for the court to say that judicial independence means that every other federal judge, Article III, life tenured judge, has to adhere to a code of ethics, but we don't. Nobody thinks that's okay. And it's really interesting because I think this is the place where we've developed this kind of learned helplessness, Al, where we forget all of the extensive history of Professor Steve Vladek at University of Texas has been documenting how many times in the past centuries Congress has exerted control over the court. They added seats. They took away seats. They forced the justices to ride circuit. They had to, like, get on ponies and drive around and sleep in barns and hear cases. Congress has added to the court's jurisdiction, changed the court's jurisdiction. So the idea that we, like, passed some threshold and now the Congress can't do anything to touch the court and that we all have to just accede to that is, like, for a country that was, like, running away from monarchic thinking, we kind of are in the soup of monarchic thinking about the court.
Yeah, and the horrible thing about this is such an illegitimate court. And I was there when they wouldn't, you know, take up Merrick Garland. You know, McConnell said, well, there's already been votes cast in New Hampshire. We're in the middle of an election. And there had been a New Hampshire primary start. You can't confirm a justice in the middle of an election year. And then Coney Barrett is sworn in, what, 9 days, 8 days before the election?
Right. Hundreds and thousands of votes had already been cast when she.
Yep. Oh, millions probably early. Yeah. Yeah. Millions of votes. And actually for president, not for a nominee for a party for president. But for precedent. And they don't square that. They never square. They only square it by lying backward. Oh, no. That was about the fact that we had the majority, right? And you don't have to take up someone if you're in the majority. Although that had never happened before. Yeah, but you didn't say that at the time. Anyway, so there's no chance that Roberts is going to do anything about this. Do you think there'll be more of these coming out?
I do. And it's probably
why wouldn't there be, right?
A whole separate conversation. But I think that, and I say this with, like, some chagrin, you know, the Supreme Court press corps has not been breaking these stories. These are investigative reporters that are treating the court as a political institution, and they're scraping data and they're finding the receipts, and they found the Harlan Crow, Leonard Leo.
How do they do that? This is such cool, this ProPublica, right?
ProPublica broke this story. Actually, the photo of the picture of the painting, the Harlan Crow painting, actually was found by Lisa Graves.
And, wait a minute, I don't even know about the painting. What's the painting?
Oh, you've seen the painting. The painting is the thing that ProPublica put out there when the first Harlan Crow stories were breaking. It showed Harlan Crow and Clarence Thomas and Leonard Leo and Mark Paoletta and a guy called Beau Rutledge sitting around in Adirondack chairs, smoking cigars and chatting.
Oh, yeah.
And it's all sort of somewhat amazing. And I think Lisa Graves, creator of True North Research, had found a photo of that painting last year, but then ProPublica published it with these stories about Harlan Crow. But like, now that it's going to be treated like a regular institution where you can go through and find the photos of Justice Thomas posing on the super yacht in the t-shirt, there's going to be a ton more of this. And I think it's not an accident that we went from these are the $500,000 cruises, this is the unreimbursed and undisclosed flights on private jets.
Wasn't the video of Thomas saying like, you know, I like humble vacations.
He likes because
that's how I grew up.
Parking lot, yeah.
Walmart and the trailer parks.
I think that it's not an accident that a whole bunch of publications that have covered the court as a sort of oracular institution that doesn't need to be scrutinized are now hiring teams of investigative reporters to sort of scrape what's out there. And I think we're going to find a lot more. And I think in addition to that, let's remember that the U.S. Supreme Court in the next 6 weeks is going to hand down decisions, probably ending affirmative action, probably, you know, ending the Indian Child Welfare Act, making it okay for web designers to refuse service to same-sex couples, making President Biden's student debt relief program go away under the Major Questions Doctrine,
right.
The
That's
Clean
huge.
Water Act is in the you know, crosshairs. There's so much going on, as is Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. So all these things are going to keep happening. And I think the question is, like, are we going to just sit there and be like, oh, well, shruggy emoji, you know, sucks that our grandkids won't have a Clean Water Act, but nothing to be done? Or are we going to start to, like, very, very seriously talk about what happens when the court refuses to accept reform and the public demands it? And I think we're at that tipping point, Al. I don't know if you feel that, but I think the public is kind of getting tired of being told that everybody follows the rules except Clarence Thomas.
But what's the follow-up on that? What can be done to reverse that? Because Roberts isn't going to do anything. I mean, I know that Sheldon has talked about the circuit court judges trying to get together and do something. Is that part of it?
Yes. There's this thing called the Judicial Conference, which is the body that regulates the courts. And Senator Whitehouse and others have asked them to take responsibility for this. And by the way, there was some breaking news late last week that judges in the Judicial Conference had been complaining about Clarence Thomas's disclosure, you know, for 10 years now, and nothing changed. There's also three different bills put forth that would force the court to adopt a code of ethics. And maybe improbably, Angus King and Susan Collins have put forth a bill essentially saying the court has to adopt its own ethics rules. But this isn't nothing, considering this was just called crack pottery 5 years ago. The idea that there's some sense that if the court doesn't clean up its act, Congress is either going to try to force them to, or try to force them to force themselves to, or force the Judicial Conference to do it. But I think that what I'm sensing is that that willingness to accede to just doing nothing seems to be going away, and that the more pressure the court feels, the more you get these kind of howling Justice Alito responses of, you just want us all to die. Like, you just want there to be threats on our lives.
Shouldn't Justice Alito be like the happiest guy in the world? Shouldn't he be like, I got rid of Roe v. Wade? Shouldn't he be like, everything I've ever wanted is happening?
Yeah, that's one of the things Donald Trump took credit for, too. He said he got rid of Roe v. Wade. But yeah, you would think that, like, well, Justices Thomas and Alito are in the catbird seat. You would think they, you know, are living their best lives right now. But what we keep hearing is this, I think, reckless conflating of any criticism of the court with, and you want there to be death threats against the justices. And because they can't separate their own sense of vulnerability. And by the way, this is Leonard Leo's defense of why he said, keep this money that I am paying to Ginni Thomas's organization off the books, is because literally his defense was, quote, knowing how disrespectful, malicious, and gossipy people can be, I have always tried to protect the privacy of Justice Thomas and Ginni. Literally, the defense is, we're grifting in secret because you all are mean to them. And it's like, the disclosure rules make it really hard for us to grift, so we have to, like, not disclose, is not a super credibility enforcing message to be pushing out there. And so I think there will be tons more of this. I think it's all going to be icky. I think that the Chief Justice has indicated that he is going to do nothing about it. And then, in fact, he's going to cloak himself in this idea that judicial independence demands that nothing be done about it. And then, like I said, I think we're going to have a shit show this spring when all these cases come down. And all of this is kind of heading off a cliff. And whether something or someone can reverse it, or whether, like, you and I are to blame for having this conversation, I think is kind of, that's where this is going. This is a pretty grim time. And I think I think that feeling of powerlessness and helplessness is like a huge contributor to the problem, because it makes us feel like there's nothing to do but watch Netflix. And I think we have to really, like, stop thinking that, you know, it's just like too bad that the king gets to do what he wants. I think we have to remember that, you know, the nature of, I will say in some earnestness, but like the nature of checks and balances is not just that the nine justices are not the only people who have skin in the game when it comes to the court's institutional legitimacy. The other branches have skin in the game. They have an obligation to check the court, but also the rest of us have skin in the game too. We have an obligation to make sure that a credible court is protecting democracy. This is not like, you know, for the kings and princes to figure out, like, on the third floor of the palace. This is like the work of our time, is to say, like, this actually, for all the gajillion reasons we talked about, from the Clean Water Act to, abortion and guns. Like, this idea that there's nothing to be done means that, like, we will keep losing.
But how do we do it? Is it just by electing Democrats? I mean, how do we do this? How do we bring this pressure to bear?
I think it's a couple of things. I think it is realizing that democracy isn't a game that's played every other year at elections, right? I think it's, how did we lose state houses? How did state houses, having been captured by, you know, extreme, extreme iterations of the Republican Party, turn around and start taking away rights from voters, as we discussed earlier, right? I think it's looking at these kind of intractable questions around gerrymandering, one person, one vote, you know, voter suppression. Like, how do we have 75-80% approval ratings in this country for background checks and for, you know, fundamental reproductive freedom? And we're losing all those things. And those are not issue problems. Those are democracy problems. And, you know, I think we talked, like, for the first third of this conversation about, if you can get the levers of democracy to work to subvert democracy, which is not just what we're seeing in red states. The Supreme Court is blessing it, right? When the Supreme Court says in Rucho, don't worry because state Supreme Courts are going to protect democracy. And here we are a couple of years later and the state Supreme Courts are being benched. Like the court is an active player in subversion of democracy. And so I think we have to like get in that game. And if that means finding independent, you know, gerrymandering reformers in your state, or if it means, you know, caring about your state AG race, or if it means, you know, those kids in Tennessee who just walked out of school until their representatives were reinstated. Like, this is all democracy stuff. Believe it or not, it's doable. We know how to do it. And by the way, we've been here before, right? In the 60s, we've been here before in Reconstruction. Like, this is doable. But I think we just have to stop thinking that watching the CNN town hall is like the limit of our participation in this thing.
Well, thanks, Dahlia. And I'll see you soon, I hope. And of course, when in June, when the court renders its all these decisions, please come back. Okay.
It is always, always, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.